If walking the street past those peckerwoods?
Uncle Wade's sunburned face was thinner than usual, and dark with outrage.
Aunt Alma just laughed at him. She looked better than ever.
She was a little thinner, too, but that was good on her. Her face was smooth and relaxed, her skirt loose on her soft hips. She didn't look like she was missing Uncle Wade too much.
That man's worse than a boy, she'd told Mama. Wears you out wanting stuff done for him all the time, running after his meals, washing his clothes. Hell, washing him and his greasy hair.
Now she just laughed and pushed her bangs back casually with one small hand.
I'm paying my own rent, thank you, Mr. Wade Yarnall.
She looped a curl around one ear and grinned over at Mama proudly.
I don't need to listen to your complaints about my life, your nonsense about my children. They're clean and fed and happy where they are. Nobody's messing with them. Nobody's messing with me, and nobody's gonna.
But it's a scandal. She can't stay there.
Aunt Carr was on Uncle Wade's side, but she always had been, Mama told me.
Carr had come down from Baltimore to stay with us on her yearly summer visit.
Your Aunt Carr was always sweet on Wade, Mama confided to me one afternoon when we were hanging out laundry. Back when we were still girls, she thought she'd marry Wade. Never got over him picking Alma.
Hellfire, Annie! Carr ain't never gotten over anything. Girl remembers every wrong anybody ever done her or thought of doing her. Bet you she recites them out loud each night before she goes to sleep, just to keep them straight in her mind.
Uncle Earl was standing at the edge of the clothesline with a big paper sack in his arms and a wide grin on his dark tanned face. He put the bag down and hugged me when I ran to him, laughing at Mama's annoyed expression.
Come on, Annie, you know what I say is true. Don't you be giving me that old angry look.
He nudged his sack.
I got enough paper shell pecans to make 2 dozen pies. Why don't you let me and your baby here pick them out for you while you roll out a bunch of pie crusts?
Mama put the last pin on a pair of Daddy Glenn's worn jockey shorts and gave a shake to one of his shirts so that the sleeves hung down straight.
Some days I don't know how anybody stands you, Earl Boatwright. Always saying the worst about everybody. I think the one who sits up nights is you, just thinking of evil-hearted things to say about people.
Earl laughed again. Oh, you're right, baby sister. I spend all my spare time making notes on things people have done that they don't want no one to talk about, and I make sure I talk about just those things.
He hefted his bag on one hip and me on the other.
Tell me, Bone, has your mama told you yet how your Aunt Carr come to live so far away in Baltimore City and come home so rarely we barely recognize her when she does?
Oh, Earl, Mama put one hand over her mouth and grabbed the pecans with the other.
Don't talk bad about Carr. Come on in and I'll get out my Carro syrup and pie pans.
Earl swung me up high so that I straddled his shoulders, my legs hanging down on either side of his neck.
Yes, ma'am. I got a taste for pecan pie, the way you make it when you're mad.
He tickled my bare foot till I grabbed his ears to make him stop.
When your mama's pissed at me, Bone, she chops the nuts up fine the way I like them. Otherwise, she don't bother. And if the nuts ain't chopped small, they don't sweeten up right for my taste.
At the screen door, he paused, and I pulled his ears again. But what about Aunt Carr? Ain't you gonna tell me how she moved to Baltimore?
He turned his head to look up at me and gave me his famous slow grin. You know your mama don't want me to tell you that story.
I kicked my feet against his chest. But ain't you gonna tell me anyway?
Earl laughed and swung me down.
He pushed the screen door with his hip and took a quick look inside to see that Mama had gone on to the kitchen.
Well,
he lit a cigarette, striking the match one-handed.
Your Aunt Carr was a sensitive girl, tender on the subject of how pretty your mama and Alma were when she wasn't much to look at herself. Carr wanted to be beautiful so much it made her mean. She used to talk so awful about Raylene, it was a shame. Insisting Raylene had to learn to use makeup and fix her hair start working on getting herself a man. But I always thought she just went on at Raylene so she could boast about how hard she worked at looking good. Raylene and Alma and your mama used to just laugh at her about it, make her so mad. I ain't saying Carr didn't love her sisters, but sometimes you could tell she didn't much like them. And, oh, she did have a thing for the young Mr. Wade. The girl just plain wanted him. And maybe she could see that he wasn't giving a minute's notice to her when Alma was around. It wore on her bad. Then one Thanksgiving, Wade joked where everyone could hear that Alma was the younger, sweeter version of Carr. The blossom next to the windfall, I think he said. Carr's face was a study right then. You could see every thought running across it, none of them pretty. And by Christmas, I swear that girl had snapped up old Baltimore Benny like he was new bait in a cold spring. Had her first baby by the next fall, and got Benny to move back up with his people right after that. It took Wade and Alma another 5 years to marry themselves, though Alma's twins waited barely long enough for the preacher to stop talking before they pushed their way out of her belly.
Earl rolled his cigarette between his thumb and forefinger.
Seems like after that we were all grown up, and everything was different. It's the way of things. One day you're all family together, fighting and hugging from one moment to the next, and then it's all gone. You're off making your own family, scared of what's coming next. And Lord, things have a way of running faster and faster all the time.
He looked off across the yard, as if he were seeing a lot more than his oil-green Chevy parked on the street.
Well, where are you?
Mama called to us from the kitchen.
I ain't gonna make no pies all by myself when you two can help.
I ran inside while Earl followed slowly behind, dropping his lanky form into a kitchen chair turned around so he could rest his chin on the back of it.
You just don't want me telling stories where you can't hear, little sister.
Lies, you mean?
Mama passed me the sifter and a bowl of flour, then poured out a mound of pecans between her and Earl. She took her big butcher knife and started rocking it back and forth across the nuts, chopping them fine.
You know, Bone, Earl's hair was a dull brown when he was a boy and started school. It just got darker and blacker every year.
She looked over at her brother with a crooked smile.
What you think, Earl? Was it school or sin that made your hair so black?
Earl palmed a mouthful of pecans, tugged on the lock that hung down over his forehead, and sighed a long, mournful moan.
Oh, school, little sister. That's why I had to quit, you know. I had to stop the process before it went too far. If I had gone on, my hair would have turned so black it would have started to absorb all the sunlight in Greenville County. Crops would have failed and children gone hungry just because of my selfish need to learn algebra and geography. I had to quit and take that job building the new runway out at the airbase. It was the only thing to do to save us from starvation and the cold, cold night.
Oh, you!
Mama slapped Earl's shoulder lightly.
I can't say nothing without you telling your awful lies.
She pulled in her rolling pin and leaned on it as she crushed a couple of cups of pecans down to mealy bits.
God's keeping track, Earl Boatwright. One of these days, your stories are gonna come back on you. You ain't gonna know what to say then, I swear.
Uncle Wade and Aunt Alma fought for weeks, with Aunt Carr and Mama stepping in now and then, until Aunt Carr had to go home to Baltimore and Daddy Glenn got laid off from his new job at the Pepsi plant, and Mama started working too hard to go visiting Aunt Alma much. It didn't look like they would ever make up, but then again, nobody acted like it was any big deal. Aunt Alma had sworn she wouldn't have Wade back in her life till he crawled the length of Main Street singing what a dog he was. But when the baby got sick and the boys started running around at night, she gave it up and moved back in with him.
I knew what he was like when I married him, Alma told Mama. I guess he ain't no worse than any other man.
But she was still mad enough not to move back into their bedroom for a few months. She treated Wade as if he were a tenant in his own house,
barely speaking to him until he apologized to her. At first, Uncle Wade was indignant, swearing that Aunt Alma would go to hell for treating him like a stranger. He did apologize eventually, though he wouldn't admit he had done anything wrong. "A man has needs," he kept telling everybody from Daddy Glenn to the gas station attendants on White Horse Road. "A man has needs, and she was pregnant. Was I gonna take the risk of hurting my own baby in her womb?" Wade's woeful complaint was a joke to all the aunts. "A man has needs," they'd laugh each time they got together. "So what do you suppose a woman has?" "Men," one of them would always answer in a giggling roar. Then they would all laugh till the tears started running down. I wasn't at all sure what was so funny, but I laughed anyway. I liked being one of the women with my aunts. Liked feeling a part of something nasty and strong, and separate from my big rough boy cousins, and the whole world of spitting, growling, overbearing males. Chapter 7. "Don't you ever let me catch you stealing," Mama commanded in one of her rare lectures, after Cousin Gray got caught running out of the White Horse Winn-Dixie with a bargain quart of RC Cola. "You want something? You tell me. And if it's worth the trouble, we'll find a way. But I ain't gonna have no child of mine caught stealing." I took Mama at her word and hung around with my cousins Garvey and Gray, planning not to get caught and not to tell Mama. But one afternoon after I produced Tootsie Rolls for Reese and me, Mama took my hands in hers like she was going to cry. "Where'd you get them?"
"Uncle Earl," I suggested.
"No."
Mama dropped down a little so her face was close to mine. "Aunt Alma." Carefully, I made my face a mask.
"Don't lie, too."
The lines in her face looked as deep as the rivers that flowed south toward Charleston.
"Tell me the truth."
I started to cry.
"Downtown with Gray and Garby this morning, at the Woolworth's counter."
Mama used her forefinger to wipe the tears off my cheeks. She wiped her own.
"Is this all of it? How many did you take?"
"Two others, Mama. I ate one, gave Reese one."
Mama leaned back in her chair, dropping my hands. She shook a cigarette out of the pack and lit it carefully. I sat still, watching her, waiting. Tears kept collecting in the corners of my eyes, and I had to turn to wipe them away on my shoulder, but I kept watching Mama's face as she sat and smoked without looking at me. The fingers of her right hand rubbed together steadily, like the legs of grasshoppers I had seen climbing up the long grass at Aunt Raylene's place. Her lips moved steadily, too, as if she were sucking on her teeth or about to speak. But she was quiet a long time, just sitting there looking off through the open window, smoking her cigarette. "You know your cousin Tommy Lee?" "Aunt Ruth's oldest boy." I frowned, trying to remember their names.
There was Dwight, I knew. Lucius, D.W., Graham, yeah, Tommy Lee, and Butch.
Aunt Ruth had only 2 daughters and 6 boys, most of them married with boys of their own. All of them were so alike that I could never keep track of anyone but Butch, and I rarely saw him anymore since he had gone to live with Ruth's oldest girl, Molly, in Oklahoma. The younger boys turned up occasionally to wrestle Reese and me, give us candy, or tell us stories. The older ones had the sunken eyes and planned faces of men, and they never gave us anything except nasty looks. I couldn't have said which of the older ones was Tommy Lee, though I'd heard people talk about him enough, about what a hard ass he was, about his girlfriends and his dirty mouth, his stints in the county jail, and the fights he got into.
"He's bad," Mama said, her eyes still looking out the window. "He's just bad all the way through. He steals from his mama. He's stolen from me. Don't you dare leave your pocketbook around him or any of your stuff that he could sell. He even took Dee Dee's green stamp books one time and traded them off for some useless thing."
Her eyes drifted back to my face, the stunned brown of the pupils shining like mossy rocks underwater.
"I remember when we were just kids, and he was always stealing candy to give away. Thought people would like him if he gave them stuff, I suppose. Now he's always saying how he's been robbed, and he's got a story to account for everything he does. Beats his girlfriends up, 'cause they cheat on him. Can't keep a job, 'cause people tell lies about him. Steals, 'cause the world's been so cruel to him. So much nonsense. He's just bad, that's all. Just bad. Steals from his mama and sisters. Steals from his own. I dropped my head. I remembered Gray telling me how he learned to break locks from Tommy Lee. That Tommy Lee was the slickest piece of goods in Greenville. Boy knows how to take care of himself for sure. Never owes nobody nothing. Gray's face had flushed with respect and envy when he said it, and I had felt a little of the same. Wishing I, too, knew how to take care of myself and could break locks or start cars without a key or palm stuff off a counter so smoothly that no one would know I had done it. But to steal from your mama? My face felt stiff with shame and anger. I wasn't like that. I would never steal from Mama. Mama's hand touched my chin, trailed along my cheek, and stroked my hair. You're my pride, do you know? You and your sister are all I really have. All I ever will have. You think I could let you grow up to be like that? I shook my head. The tears started again, and with them, hiccups. Mama went and got a cool washcloth to wet my face. Don't cry, honey. It'll be all right. We'll take care of it. It'll be all right. She put the Tootsie Rolls in a paper bag and gave me a handful of pennies to carry. She kept talking while she brushed my hair and then hers. Called Reese in and told her to stay on the porch, turned the heat down on the beans that were cooking on the stove, and walked me out to the car. She told me about when she and Aunt Raylene were girls, how they had worked for this man out past Old Henderson Road, picking strawberries for pennies every day for weeks, going through the rows and pulling the loose red ripe ones for him to sell in his stand by the side of the road. Only the ripe ones, he kept telling us, but it was so hot and the dust was so thick. Sometimes we'd pull up the ones that weren't quite ripe, you know, green ones or half green anyway. We'd hide them under the ripe ones when we set them up for him. People would buy a box, and then get home to find those half-ripe ones, call him up to complain. He'd get so mad, but we were just kids, and his yelling didn't bother us so long as he kept paying us for the work. What'd he pay you? Mama waved her hand as if that didn't matter. Not enough, you know. Not enough. Strawberry picking is terrible work. Hurts your back, your eyes. You get that juice all over you, get those little prickers in your hands. Ain't enough money in it even for children, even if you eat as many as you can. After a while, you don't want any anyway. She laughed. Though Raylene sure could eat a lot. Faster than you could see, she'd swallow handfuls of berries. Only proof she'd been eating them was her red, red tongue. She stopped the car in front of the Woolworths, cut the engine, and sat for a moment, her hands resting on the wheel. I looked out at the big display windows, where stacks of plastic picnic baskets, little tin office waste cans, and sleeveless cotton sundresses on hangers were squeezed behind ratty stuffed animals and tricycles with multicolored plastic streamers on the handlebars. The thought of going back in there with Mama made me feel sick to my stomach and almost angry at her. Why couldn't she just let me promise never to do it again? Her hand on my shoulder made me jump. Your granny found out what we'd been doing. 'Cause we got lazy, you know, and started putting more and more green ones in the bottom of the boxes. Grandpa laughed about it, but your granny didn't laugh. She came over there one afternoon and turned half a dozen boxes upside down, collected a bucket of green strawberries, and paid the man for them. Took us home, sat us at the kitchen table, and made us eat every one of them. Raylene and I puked strawberries all night long. You must have hated her. Mama was quiet, and I got scared. I didn't want her to think I hated her. I didn't even want to be angry at her. I clamped my teeth tight and tried not to start crying again. "There ain't no other way to do it," she said quietly. "I hate it. You hate it. You might hate me for it, I don't know, and I can't say what might happen now. But I just don't know no other way to do it. We're gonna go in there and give the man back his candy, pay for what you ate, and that will be all there is to it. It will be over, and you'll be glad it's settled. We won't ever have to mention it again." Mama opened the door briskly, and I followed her numbly. There was a flush on her cheeks as she walked me back to the candy counter, waited for the sales girl to come over, and stood me right in front of her. "My daughter has something to tell you," she said, and gave me a little push, but I couldn't speak. I held out the bag and the pennies and started to cry again, this time sobbing loud. The girl looked confused, but Mama wouldn't say anything else, just gave me another little push. I thought I'd strangle on my tongue when the manager walked over to us.
"What's this?" he said in a booming voice. "What's this? You got something for us, little girl?"
He was a big man, with a wide face and a swollen belly poking out from under a buttoned-up vest. He stooped down so that his face was right in front of me. So close, I could smell the sharp alcohol scent of aftershave.
"You do, don't you, honey?"
He looked like he was swallowing an urge to laugh at us. I was suddenly so angry at him, my stomach seemed to curl up inside me. I shoved the bag at him, the pennies. "I stole it. I'm sorry. I stole it." Mama's hand squeezed my shoulder, and I heard the breath come out of her in a sigh. I closed my eyes for a moment, trying hard not to get as mad at her as I was at that man.
"Uh-huh,"
he said.
"I see."
I looked up at him again. He was rummaging in the bag, counting the Tootsie Rolls and nodding.
"It's a good thing, ma'am," he said, still talking loudly, "that you caught this when you did."
He nodded at me.
"You're a fortunate little girl. Truly fortunate. Your mama loves you. She doesn't want you to grow up to be a thief."
He stood back up and passed the pennies to the sales girl. He stretched a hand out like he was going to put it on my head, but I stepped back so that he would have to bend forward to reach me.
"Son of a bitch," Gray would have called him. "Slimy son of a bitch, probably eats Tootsie Rolls all day long."
If he reached for me again, I decided, I'd bite him. But he just looked at me long and carefully. I knew I was supposed to feel ashamed, but I didn't anymore. I felt outraged. I wanted to kick him or throw up on him or scream his name on the street. The longer he looked at me, the more I hated him. If I could have killed him with my stare, I would have. The look in his eyes told me that he knew what I was thinking.
"I'm gonna do your mama a favor," he smiled. "Help her to teach you the seriousness of what you've done."
Mama's hand tightened on my shoulder, but she didn't speak.
"What we're gonna do,"
he announced,
"is say you can't come back in here for a while. We'll say that when your mama thinks you've learned your lesson, she can come back and talk to me. But till then, we're gonna remember your name, what you look like."
He leaned down again.
"You understand me, honey?" I understood. I understood that I was barred from the Woolworth's counters. I could feel the heat from my mama's hand through my blouse, and I knew she was never going to come near this place again, was never going to let herself stand in the same room with that honey-greased bastard.
I looked around at the bright hairbrushes, ribbons, trays of panties and socks, notebooks, dolls, and balloons. It was a hunger I felt then, raw and terrible, a shaking deep down inside me, as if my rage had used up everything I had ever eaten. After that, when I passed the Woolworth's windows, it would come back. That dizzy, desperate hunger edged with hatred and an aching lust to hurt somebody back. I wondered if that kind of hunger and rage was what Tommy Lee felt when he went through his mama's pocketbook. It was a hunger in the back of the throat, not the belly. An echoing emptiness that ached for the release of screaming. Whenever we went to visit Daddy Glenn's people, that hunger would throb and swell behind my tongue until I found myself standing silent and hungry in the middle of a family gathering full of noise and food. It was not only Daddy Glenn's brothers being lawyers and dentists instead of mechanics and roofers that made them so different from Boatwright's. In Daddy Glenn's family, the women stayed at home. His own mama had never held a job in her life, and Daryl and James both spoke badly of women who would leave their children to work outside the home. His father, Bodine Waddell, owned the Sunshine Dairy, and regularly hired and fired men like my mother's brothers, something he never let us forget.
"Awful proud for a man runs cows," Beau said of him once,
and Glenn was immediately indignant.
"Daddy don't have to handle the cows," he told Earl. "Farmers all over the county bring him their milk, or he has it picked up. Daddy just processes the milk, bottles it under the Sunshine label, and his trucks deliver it."
"Oh, yeah,"
Earl nodded solemnly.
"That's a big difference, that is. Man don't run cows. He just leases the rights to their titties."
Glenn looked like he was going to spit or cry, but controlled himself.
"Just don't say nothing about my daddy," he almost growled. "Just don't."
Earl and Beau let it go at that. Glenn couldn't help what a shit his daddy was, and it was never smart to talk bad about a man's people to his face. With the passage of time, Glenn had gotten more and more peculiar about his family. One moment complaining of how badly they treated him, and the next explaining it away. Worst of all, he insisted that we all had to go over to his brother's or daddy's places whenever there was any kind of family occasion, though it was clear to me that they were never happy to see us. We wound up going over to Daddy Waddell's place at least once every other month. In the Pontiac with the top down and paper scraps blowing around on the floor, Reese and I would lean over the front seat to watch Mama try to keep her hair neat in the whistling wind, and listen to Daddy Glenn lie.
"We won't stay long," he would always promise.
And Mama would smile like she didn't care at all. We gritted our teeth. We knew that he would not have the nerve to leave before his father had delivered his lecture on all the things Glenn had done wrong in his long life of failure and disappointment. "Your daddy wants his daddy to be proud of him," Mama once said. "It about breaks my heart. He should just as soon whistle for the moon." It was true. Around his father, Glenn became unsure of himself and too careful. He broke out in a sweat, and his eyes kept flickering back to his daddy's face as if he had to keep watching or miss the thing he needed most to see. He would pull at his pants like a little boy and drop his head if anyone asked him a question. It was hard to put that image of him next to the way he was all the rest of the time. The swaggering bantam rooster man who called himself my daddy.
"Old Glenn's a cock and a half," my Uncle Earl would tease. "Ain't nobody better take a bite out of his ass. Boy'll get you down if it takes bare bone to do it."
Which was true enough. Half a dozen times, I came home from school to find Mama and Glenn sitting at the kitchen table with that wide-eyed, scared look that meant he'd jumped somebody who'd said something to him and lost yet another job.
"Man can't keep his temper," Granny complained,
but grinned in spite of herself.
Everybody did.
It was the one thing that saved Daddy Glenn from the Boatwright's absolute contempt. The berserker rage that would come on him was just a shade off the power of one of the Boatwright's famous binges.
"You mess with one of those boys, and you reap the whirlwind," people said of my uncles,
and after a while, of Daddy Glenn. Tire irons and pastry racks, pitchforks and mop handles. Things got bent or broken around Daddy Glenn. His face would pink up, and his hands would shake. His neck would start to work, the muscles ridging up and throbbing. Then his mouth would swell and he would spit. Words came out that were not meant to be understood.
"Goddamn motherfucker, son of a bitch, shit ass!"
Magic words that made other men back off,
put their hands up, palms out, and whisper back, "Now, Glenn, now, Glenn, now, hold on, boy. Your daddy's a son of a bitch himself, a purely crazy pig fucker," Gray was always telling me with a little awe in his voice. A hunger to be half again as dangerous. I'd smile and nod and bite the inside of my lips, replaying in my head two separate movie images. Daddy Glenn screaming at me, his neck bright red with rage. And the other impossible vision just by it. Daddy Glenn at his daddy's house, with his head hanging down and his mouth so soft, spit shone on the lower lip. "I hate to go over there," Mama said. "Hate standing around waiting for his daddy to notice us." She was brushing our hair out fine and loose and putting little barrettes up on the peak where she wanted it to stay back. Reese and I stood still and said nothing. We knew we were not supposed to pay attention when Mama talked about Daddy Glenn's people. "Whose birthday is it?" was about the only safe thing to ask, since it was always somebody's birthday or a wedding or a christening. The Waddells didn't have as many cousins and aunts and uncles as we did, but the women still made babies. Somebody was always celebrating something. One Sunday it was a double, a birthday for James and one of his kids.
"One of the children,"
Daddy Glenn's sister-in-law Madeline corrected me. "Kids are billy goats." "Goddamn right," I thought, staring over at my puffy cousin in creased pants, an 8-year-old copy of his fat, ugly father. They served us tea in the backyard, just us. Annie's girls, they called us. Their kids went in and out of the house, loud, raucous, scratching their nails on the polished furniture, kicking their feet on the hardwood floors, tracking mud in on the braided rugs. "Those little brats need their asses slapped." Mama was sitting with us at the picnic table in the garden, out where no one could hear her. She'd come to check on us where we sat in our starched dresses, our faces as stiff as the sleeves. Reese and I were sweaty and miserable, trying not to wiggle around on the benches, to look well-behaved for Mama's sake, and stay out of the way of those kids who hated us as much as we did them.
"When are we going?" we kept asking Mama, knowing she couldn't tell us, but asking just the same.
"Soon," she'd say, and light another cigarette with shaking hands. Mama didn't smoke in Daddy Waddell's house, though no one ever told her she couldn't. They just didn't leave ashtrays out. But I once saw Madeline smoking over near the kitchen sink, dropping her ashes down the drain. It made me wonder if all of them went off in the kitchen or bathroom to smoke, pretending the rest of the time that they didn't have any such dirty habits.
"Can't we go home now?"
"No. James wants to show Daddy his new lawnmower."
"I thought he got a new one last year." "This one's the kind that you can ride on while you cut the grass."
"Don't seem the yard's big enough to need that."
"Well," Mama gave a short laugh, "I don't think James buys anything just 'cause he needs it."
She brushed herself down carefully before going back in, though there wasn't a speck of ash on her.
"You girls play nice now."
We sat still, wonderfully behaved, almost afraid to move.
"Yes, ma'am. No, ma'am."
We kept our back straight and never spoke out of turn, trying to imagine that Daddy Glenn would look out and see us and be proud. His people watched us out the windows. Behind them, shelves of books and framed pictures mocked me. How could Reese and I be worthy of all that? The roses in their garden, the sunlight on those polished windows and flowered drapes, the china plates gleaming behind glass cabinets. I stared in at the spines of those books, wanting it all. Wanting the furniture, the garden, the big open kitchen with its dishes for every day and others for special, the freezer in the utility room, and the plushy seats on all the dining room chairs. Reese tugged at my arm, wanting me to talk to her, but I couldn't speak around the hunger in my throat. From behind the rose bushes, I heard Daryl and James talking.
"Look at that car. Just like any nigger trash, getting something like that."
"What'd you expect? Look what he married."
"Her and her kids sure go with that car."
I pushed my black hair out of my eyes
and looked in at one of my wide-mouthed cousins in a white dress with eyelet sleeves looking back at me, scratching her nose and staring like I was some elephant in a zoo, something dumb and ugly and impervious to hurt. What do they tell her about us? I wondered. That we're not really family? Just her crazy uncle's wife's nasty kids? You're no relative of mine. You're not my people, I whispered to myself. New and terrible words rolled around in my head while the air turned cool on my neck. To Reese's surprise, I got up, shook out my skirt, and strolled off for a walk through Madeline's rose bushes. I put my hands out and trailed them lightly along the thorny stalks and plush blossoms, scooping buds off as I passed. I pulled the buds apart, tearing the petals and dropping them down inside my dress. I even pulled up my skirt and tucked some in my panties, walking more slowly then to feel the damp, silky flowers moving against my skin. Trash steals, I thought, echoing Aunt Madeline's cold accent, her husband's bitter words. Trash for sure, I muttered, but I only took the roses. No hunger would make me take anything else of theirs. I could feel a kind of heat between my eyes that lit up everything I glanced at. It was dangerous, that heat. It wanted to pour out and burn everything up. Everything they had that we couldn't have. Everything that made them think they were better than us. I stood in the garden and spun myself around and around, pouring out heat and rage and the sweet stink of broken flowers. Chapter 8. I was 10, a long-boned, restless 10, when we moved to West Greenville, so Daddy could be closer to the new uniform plant where he'd gotten a job as an account salesman. Boxing up dishes and pots in the utility shed, Mama found the remains of the love knot Aunt Maybelle and Aunt Marvella had given her. It had been reduced to scraps held together by dust, and seemed to have survived only because it had fallen between the bottom of one flower pot and the bowl of another. Mice had picked the ribbon apart from the hair, and bugs had carried off most of the herbs and blood. Even so, the knotted core of the old lace scrap had somehow held all that time. Mama recognized the thing from the color of the ribbon. "That was a wedding present from your Eustace aunts," Mama told me, but I already knew what it was from Granny's stories. As Mama carefully tried to gather it up, the whole thing fell to dust. My stomach cramped, and I wrapped my arms tighter on my middle. Impatiently, Mama swept out the shed and packed up her laundry baskets. "Root magic," she muttered to me. That week, Marvella woke up in the night after dreaming her hair had turned to barbed wire, and Maybelle woke up in the morning, sure the rabbits had eaten all their beans. They found instead that a dog had dug up the honeycomb and torn right through the lace. Neither of them told the other what they thought it meant. The new house in West Greenville was so far from any of the aunts' houses that there was rarely time to stop by and see them. Granny was still keeping Reese for Mama when she could, but it was out of the way to take her to Alma's and pick her up, and Mama decided maybe it was time to start trusting me to keep us both alive while she was at work. After that, we only saw Granny on the Sundays when Mama would let Daddy Glenn sleep and take us over to visit with Aunt Ruth or Aunt Alma. "Hate you being so far away," her sisters would complain. But Mama would just smile and tell them how nice our new house was, how hard Daddy Glenn was working. And it was a nice house, with a big, wide yard, but it also cost more, which meant Mama had to take on a few extra hours to bring in a little more money. It didn't seem as if Daddy Glenn's route was working out as well as they had hoped. "Your daddy's having to work awfully hard these days," Mama told us. "You girls be quiet when he gets home. Stay out of his way and let him get his rest." "He loves you," Mama was always saying, and she meant it. But it seemed like Daddy Glenn's hands were always reaching for me, trembling on the surface of my skin, as if something pulled him to me and pushed him away at the same time. I would look up at him, carefully, watchfully, and see his eyes staring at me like I was something unimaginable and strange. "You don't look like your mama," he said once,
except when you're asleep.
Sometimes when I ran by him, his hands would suddenly catch me, half lift me, and pull me back to him. He would look into my face, shake me once, and let me go.
"Don't run like that," he'd say. "You're a girl, not a racehorse."
Reese and I joked about that and played racehorses when we got home from school every day, running through the empty house and jumping on the big hassock that sat in front of his chair. One day, we chased each other into the house as always, not noticing the car out back, not seeing Daddy Glenn until he caught my shoulder in one big hand.
"What did I tell you?"
he shouted, and lifted me high, shaking me back and forth till my head rocked on my neck.
"You bitch, you little bitch."
My body slammed the wall, my heels knocking hollowly a foot above the floor. I saw Reese run away through a shimmering wave of dizziness, and then I was under his arm, being carried down the hall to the bathroom. He kicked the door shut behind us and dropped me.
"I'm sorry, I'm sorry."
I was so frightened I stuttered.
"Not as sorry as you're gonna be."
He pulled his belt free from the loops and wrapped the buckle end around his palm.
"I've waited a long time to do this. Too long."
His face was pale, his jaw rigid, his eyes almost red in the glare of the fluorescent light over the mirror. I stumbled back against the tub, terrified, praying Mama would come home fast. Mama would stop him. His left hand reached for me, caught my shoulder, pulled me over his left leg. He flipped my skirt up over my head and jammed it into that hand. I heard the sound of the belt swinging up, a song in the air, a high-pitched, terrible sound. It hit me and I screamed. Daddy Glenn swung his belt again. I screamed at its passage through the air, screamed before it hit me. I screamed for Mama. He was screaming with me, his great hoarse shouts as loud as my high, thin squeals. And behind us, outside the locked door, Reese was screaming too. And then Mama. All of us were screaming, and no one could help. When Daddy Glenn unlocked the door, Mama slapped him and grabbed me up in her arms. He held one hand to his cheek and watched as I hiccuped and cried into her neck.
"You son of a bitch," she cursed him, and ran water to wash my face.
"She's my girl too," he said. "Someone's gotta love her enough to care how she turns out."
His face was sullen, swollen, and empty, like he had woken up from a long, long sleep.
"I don't want to hear it,"
Mama yelled, pushing him out the door. She pulled me on her lap and washed my face, my neck, the backs of my swollen thighs.
"Oh, my baby,"
she kept saying. I lay still against her, grateful to be safe in her arms. The air felt funny on my skin, and I had screamed so hard I had no voice left. I said nothing, let Mama talk, only half hearing what she was whispering.
"Baby,"
she called me.
"Oh, girl. Oh, honey. Baby, what did you do? What did you do?"
What had I done? I had run in the house. What was she asking? I wanted her to go on talking and understand without me saying anything. I wanted her to love me enough to leave him, to pack us up and take us away from him, to kill him if need be. I held on to her until she put me to bed. Held on to her and whimpered then. I held on to her until I fell into a drugged, miserable sleep. I woke up to the sound of them talking, their words echoing through the closed door of the bedroom. I heard everything he said. Heard Mama crying in his arms. Daddy Glenn told her I had called him a bastard, that I had come running through the house knocking things over and called him that name. He cried and swore he hadn't meant to beat me so bad. He didn't know what had made him do it. He sobbed and then beat his fists against the mattress so hard the springs squeaked.
"She told me she hated me," he said. "Told me I would never be her daddy. And I went crazy, Annie. I just went crazy. Do you know? Do you understand how much I love you all, love her, and, oh God, Annie, they laid me off today, just put me out without a care, and what am I going to do to feed these girls now?"
Reese lay on the bed with me, her fingers in her mouth, her eyes enormous. She said nothing. I lay still, listening to Daddy Glenn's lies, wondering if he thought he was telling the truth. I kept looking into Reese's face, her baby face, smooth and empty and scared. The sound of Mama crying grew softer, faded. In the stillness that followed, I heard Daddy Glenn whispering, heard a murmur as Mama replied. Then there was a sigh, and the creak of their bed as he comforted Mama and she comforted him. Sex. They were making love. Mama sighing and sobbing, and Daddy Glenn repeating her name over and over. I looked into Reese's eyes, and we listened to the small sounds they were making.
"You made him mad," Reese whispered. "You better be careful."
I tried to be careful, but something had come apart. Something had gotten loose like the wild strands of Aunt Marvella's hair unraveling in the dust. There was no way I could be careful enough. No way to keep Daddy Glenn from exploding into rage. Dr. Pepper took him on as a route man, but at less pay than the uniform service. He had one of the short routes, not much money to be made on it, and not enough work to make it full-time. He came home at odd hours, early and late. Mama started working later and later for whatever money she could get, and I stayed out of the house as much as I could. If I went home when he was there and Mama wasn't, he was always finding something I'd done, something I had to be told, something he just had to do because he loved me. And he did love me. He told me so over and over again, holding my body tight to his hands shaking as they moved restlessly, endlessly, over my belly, ass, and thighs. "You're just like your Mama," he'd say, and press his stubbly cheek to mine. I would stand rigid, ashamed, but unable to pull away, afraid of making him angry, afraid of what he might tell Mama, and at the same time, afraid of hurting his feelings. "Daddy," I would start to whisper, and he would whisper back, "Don't you know how I love you?" And I would recoil. No, I did not know. He never said, "Don't tell your Mama." He never had to say it. I did not know how to tell anyone what I felt, what scared me and shamed me and still made me stand, unmoving and desperate, while he rubbed against me and ground his face into my neck. I could not tell Mama. I would not have known how to explain why I stood there and let him touch me. It wasn't sex, not like a man and woman pushing their naked bodies into each other. But then, it was something like sex, something powerful and frightening that he wanted badly, and I did not understand at all. Worse, when Daddy Glenn held me that way, it was the only time his hands were gentle. And when he let me go, I would rock on uncertain feet. Daddy Glenn smelled of sweat and Coca-Cola, of aftershave and cigarettes, but mostly of something I could not name, something acid, bitter, and sharp. Fear. It might have been fear. But I could not have said if it was his fear or mine. I could not say anything. I only knew that there was something I was doing wrong, something terrible. He said, "You drive me crazy," in a strange, distracted voice, and I shuddered, but believed him. I became even more afraid of Daddy Glenn, the palms that slapped, the fingers that dug in and bruised, the knuckles he would sometimes press directly under my eyes, the hands that shook and gripped and lifted me up until his eyes would stare into mine. My own hands were so small, my fingers thin and weak. I wished they were bigger, wider, stronger. I wished I was a boy so I could run faster, stay away more, or even hit him back. Gray gave me a rubber ball, hard rubber, black and small enough to hide in my hand. I cupped it in my palms so no one would see. I worked that ball with passion, rolled it between my fingers with determination, squeezed it stubbornly, clenching each finger against my thumbs. One day, my hands would be as strong as Daddy Glenn's were. No matter the size, I told myself, one day my hands would be a match for his. Some days I thought I was working that ball so hard I could grow to be more like him. Other days, I knew that wasn't why. That spring,
Earl and Daddy Glenn argued over some tools Daddy Glenn swore he had loaned Earl and never gotten back. Earl took offense and stopped coming over to visit. After that, Daddy Glenn started talking bad about the boat rights all the time, glaring at me if I asked Mama anything about what he now called that trash. He made fun of how often the uncles would get blind drunk and shoot up each other's trucks. He talked dirty about Mama's nieces, who were always sneaking off to the Rhythm Ranch to sip whiskey and dance with men older than their fathers. No matter what Daddy Glenn said, Mama never said much at all. Her face was tired all the time.
"I don't want to hear it,"
she'd say when I tried to tell her something Granny or Aunt Alma had passed on to me. "Nothing to be proud of in shooting people for looking at you wrong." I was ashamed of the way Daddy Glenn talked. But Mama didn't seem ashamed. She just got quiet, more and more quiet all the time. I begged her to tell me stories like Granny did, but she said I was too young to hear such things. Maybe when I was grown and had my own family, she would tell me what few things she thought I needed to know. But until then, she expected me to ask no questions she didn't want to answer. Glenn was right, Mama told me. She didn't want me to grow up as wild and mean as Earl or Beau, or even Raylene. When Daddy Glenn beat me, there was always a reason, and Mama would stand right outside the bathroom door. Afterward, she would cry and wash my face and tell me not to be so stubborn, not to make him mad. I'd promise, but I had a talent for sassing back and making Daddy Glenn mad, though it was hard to know how not to make him mad. Sometimes when I looked up into his red features and blazing eyes, I knew that it was nothing I had done that made him beat me. It was just me, the fact of my life, who I was in his eyes and mine. I was evil. Of course I was. I admitted it to myself, locked my fingers into fists, and shut my eyes to everything I did not understand. "Bone," Cousin Dee Dee was the first to call me Bone, but everyone did by the time we were living in West Greenville. Dog Bone, Penny Bone, Suckle Bone, Milk Tooth, Goat Head, Horse Head, Tiger Bone, Collar Bone, Hip Bone, Neck Bone, Knees and Toes.
"You are hard as bone, the stubbornest child on the planet," Daddy Glenn told me. "Cold's death, mean as a snake, and twice as twisty."
Daddy Glenn was careful not to hit me when one of the aunts was visiting, and never much when Mama would see, except for those times he could justify his discipline, dragging me into the bathroom while she waited on the other side of the locked door. It was when Reese and I were alone with him that he was dangerous. If I ran from him, he would come after me. He shook me so hard my head wobbled loosely, and he'd joke that chickens and goats had more starch to them than a boat ride, even a half-boat ride like I was. It was the bones in my head I thought about, the hard, porous edge of my skull cradling my brain, reassuring me that no matter what happened, I could heal up from it eventually. It was the heat in my heart, my hard, gritty center. I linked my fingers behind my head, clenched my teeth, and rocked back and forth. The sturdy stock we were boasted to be came down in me to stubbornness and bone. I was always getting hurt, it seemed, in ways Mama could not understand and I could not explain. Mama worried about how careless I was, how prone to accident I had become.
"Maybe you're thin-boned," she guessed,
and started buying me vitamins. I didn't know what to say to her. To say anything would mean trying to tell her everything. To describe those times when he held me tight to his belly, it called me sweet names I did not want to hear. I remained silent, stubborn, resentful, and collected my bruises as if they were unavoidable. There were lumps at the back of my head, not swellings of flesh and tissue, but a rumpled ridge of bone. My big toes went flat and wide, broken within a few months of each other when I smashed into door jams, running while looking back over my shoulder.
"How could you do that?" Mama asked me.
It was my fault. I wasn't supposed to run in the house.
"She's always getting into something," Daddy Glenn complained. "Lucky she's such a hard-headed brat."
I watched him from under lowered lashes. My head turned slightly to the side, careful not to grin out of my unmarked, stubborn face.
"Bone, be more careful," Mama begged me.
I didn't daydream about fire anymore. Now I imagined people watching while Daddy Glenn beat me, though only when it was not happening. When he beat me, I screamed and kicked and cried like the baby I was. But sometimes, when I was safe and alone, I would imagine the ones who watched. Someone had to watch. Some girl I admired who barely knew I existed. Some girl from church or down the street, or one of my cousins, or even somebody I had seen on television. Sometimes a whole group of them would be trapped into watching. They couldn't help or get away. They had to watch. In my imagination, I was proud and defiant. I'd stare back at him with my teeth set, making no sound at all. No shameful scream, no begging. Those who watched admired me and hated him. I pictured it that way and put my hands between my legs. It was scary, but it was thrilling, too. Those who watched me loved me. It was as if I was being beaten for them. I was wonderful in their eyes. My fantasies got more violent and more complicated as Daddy Glenn continued to beat me with the same two or three belts he'd set aside for me. Oiled, smooth, and supple as the gristle under chicken fat. Those belts hung behind the door of his closet where I could see them and smell them when I helped Mama put away his clothes. I would reach up and touch the leather, feel it warm under my palms. There was no magic in it, no mystery. Sometimes I would make myself go in that closet and wrap my fingers around those belts as if they were something animal that could be tamed. I was ashamed of myself for the things I thought about when I put my hands between my legs. More ashamed for masturbating to the fantasy of being beaten than for being beaten in the first place. I lived in a world of shame. I hid my bruises as if they were evidence of crimes I had committed. I knew I was a sick, disgusting person. I couldn't stop my stepfather from beating me, but I was the one who masturbated. I did that. And how could I explain to anyone that I hated being beaten, but still masturbated to the story I told myself about it? Yet it was only in my fantasies with people watching me that I was able to defy Daddy Glenn. Only there that I had any pride. I loved those fantasies, even though I was sure they were a terrible thing. They had to be. They were self-centered, and they made me have shuddering orgasms. In them, I was very special. I was triumphant, important. I was not ashamed. There was no heroism possible in the real beatings. There was just being beaten until I was covered with snot and misery. My collarbone fused with a lump the second time it was broken. An accident, Daddy Glenn insisted, just like the first time when I had fallen off the porch. In the hospital, the young intern glared and ordered lots of x-rays. "How'd she break her coccyx?" he demanded of Mama over the sheaf of x-rays when we were ready to go home. He had a funny accent and a mass of black, curly hair. He leaned over Mama like he was going to hit her.
"Her what?"
"Her tailbone, lady, her ass. What have you been hitting this child with? Or have you just been throwing her up against the wall?"
"What are you saying?"
Mama's face was white and stiff. His was red and angry.
"What are you saying?"
This time, Mama's voice went high and loud. A middle-aged nurse in a rumpled uniform was suddenly at my right side, one hand on the doctor's arm and the other reaching for Mama. There was a tag on her pocket that read, "Meyer."
"Let's not get excited," she said. "Let's calm down."
The doctor took hold of my chin. His fingers were warm, the skin rough and dry.
"Tell us," he said. "You tell us."
I looked into his pupils, and I could see myself there. My face tiny and strange above the bandage wrapping my shoulder and arm. He looked angry and impatient and disgusted. He glared at Mama with no pity at all. I could feel Mama's fingers gripping the palm of my free hand, hear her breathing like she was going to be sick. When I looked up into her face, I saw her terror, and behind it her love for me. Daddy Glenn was outside waiting in the car with Reese. The nurse started talking, but I didn't listen.
"Mama, take me home," I whispered.
Mama's hand slipped around my waist.
Her fingers felt icy through the thin cotton material of my blouse. Icy but comforting.
Let go of my girl, she told the doctor.
His mouth twisted, and he gave my chin a little shake. I let my eyes move over.